So today's talk is almost entirely on searches for the standard model Higgs boson, where in this case what we call standard model Higgs boson is any Higgs that's produced in the Higgs drawing process with a standard model cross-section. I'll review briefly the physics of the Higgs mechanism and the Higgs boson in the standard model, in particular giving reasons why we think that there's something out there to be discovered and where we might expect to look for it and how to look for it. I'll give a brief summary of some of the things that were done to LEP within the last few years in order to increase its energy and luminosity to increase the sensitivity to Higgs boson searches. Then I'll describe the search channels, how to combine them between search channels, energies, and between the LEP experiments, and then show the results. These results will be the same as those shown at the November 3rd meeting of the LEP committee, and the main reason for that is that we're still waiting for some inputs from L3 so that we cannot update our results until the final approval is gotten from the four experiments. So this is an interesting political situation, of course. You have to have approval from everyone before you can show a combined result. So we must have something in addition to the standard model to break the symmetry that predicts the existence of the W and the Z. The SU2 left cross U1 Y gauge symmetry predicts to high precision the observables that we have been able to measure at LEP and SLC to about 0.1% for a good many of these observables. However, this gauge symmetry predicts that the W and the Z are massless, just as the photon is massless with the U1 symmetry in QED. The simplest solution was introduced nearly 35 years ago, actually 36 years ago, by Peter Higgs. And that introduces, the solution introduces a complex doublet with 4 degrees of freedom, which has this particular curious potential with a negative squared mass term and a positive self-coupling. This gives it, just a picture of that, an interesting situation where the Higgs field, in this case, the ground state is not at 0, 0, it has a value different from 0, which is the vacuum expectation value. And it breaks the SU2 cross U1 symmetry down to U1 symmetry because the particular value that the vacuum has chosen for the field is non-symmetric in this particular potential. Having broken 3 parameters of symmetry means that there should be 3 massless Nambu-Goldstone bosons in the model. However, these appear in the standard model as the longitudinal polarizations of the W plus, the W minus, and the Z. There's only one more left of the 4 degrees of freedom, and this last degree of freedom appears as the Higgs scalar, which is what we're looking for at LEP. We have more reasons to believe that there must be some Higgs scalar. In particular, the fermion sector demands it because the W couples only to left-handed fermions, not to right-handed ones, which means that the left-handed ones belong to SU2 doublets, but the right-handed ones belong in singlets, which means that the left and right-handed fermions have different quantum numbers. If you introduce a mass term into the Lagrangian, then this violates the gauge symmetry because the left-handed and right-handed ones can't couple without something to satisfy the quantum number. In this case, it's hypercharge conservation at the vertex. The Higgs field has exactly the right hypercharge to account for fermion mass. We have yet another reason to believe that there's a Higgs scalar. If you have a model of electroweak interactions with W's and Z's in it without a Higgs boson, then the scattering amplitude for W plus W minus goes to W plus W minus, grows without bound with increasing energy. This is canceled by contributions from Higgs boson exchange shown here. There are similar diagrams with photon and Z exchange, which account for the divergent other piece. So where we like to search for the Higgs boson depends on where we believe that the Higgs boson might be. And there are some bounds that come from just considering the standard model with the particle content that we've already observed. In particular, the top quark mass has a profound implication of where the Higgs boson may be found. There's an upper bound and a lower bound on the Higgs boson mass shown on the vertical axis here. as a function of the scale of new physics, because new particles in the theory can run around in loops and correct the Higgs boson mass. If there are no new particles up to a very high mass scale, like the Planck scale, then the Higgs mass is constrained to be between approximately 140 and 180 GeV. The top bound comes from the Landau-Pohl argument, which hypothesizes that the Higgs boson self-coupling remained finite at all energy scales. The lower bound, however, is more important in this case because it's near where our experimental sensitivity is, and I'll describe that on the next slide. The lower bound comes from requiring that the vacuum be stable for the Higgs potential. The Higgs potential gets a correction at one loop from a Higgs boson running around and the quartic coupling from a Higgs loop and also from a top loop. This gives a positive correction to the Higgs self-coupling, and this gives a negative correction to the Higgs self-coupling. Because the Higgs coupling to heavy fermions, well, to all fermions, increases with the fermion mass, the heavy top mass makes this term quite large. In fact, it grows quartically with the top mass. So if the top mass is large enough, this term can dominate over that one and make the Higgs self-coupling go negative. Requiring that the Higgs self-coupling remain positive means that the Higgs mass must have be at least approximately 120, 130 or so GeV from this plot, and it depends on the scale of new physics. So that's the lower curve there. We'd like additional information of where to look for Higgs bosons, in particular because Higgs bosons exist in extended models like supersymmetry. We get some of this information from our precision electroweak measurements, which you got a talk on last week from Michael Peskin. The precision electroweak observables like E plus E minus goes to fermions, the total cross-section and asymmetries depend on these oblique corrections, if you will, which have top quarks or other quarks running around in the Z propagator. In addition, there are contributions from Higgs loops in the Z propagator here. These must be understood precisely in order to isolate the pieces that come from there. So now that the Tevatron has measured the top quark mass to 5 GeV, then the remaining residual discrepancies in the precision electroweak measurement can be used to constrain the Higgs boson mass. Unfortunately, the precision variables are only logarithmically dependent on the Higgs boson mass. The news in precision electroweak physics comes mainly recently from measurements of the forward-backward asymmetry of B quarks at an unpolarized collider, not what I did as a graduate student. So these are the LEP measurements from Delphi and Aleph, which got updated for the Morion conference in March. The central value of the forward-backward asymmetry really didn't move, but the error bar shrunk, thus pulling up the measured value sine squared theta W effective when you combine it with all of the other measurements. The leptonic measurements tend to be on the low side, and the hadronic measurements are on the right, are a bit on the high side. So given the new forward-backward asymmetry measurements, this has pulled up the predicted value of the Higgs boson mass from 68 GeV from the Osaka conference of last summer to 98 GeV as of Morion. And I'll show that on this slide here. So this is the chi-squared of the precision electroweak fit as a function of the Higgs boson mass, or you might guess that it might be. And the central value is now at 98 GeV. This shows it for two values of the fine structure constant for electromagnetic interactions at the Z mass scale. The 95% confidence level upper limit on where the Higgs boson can be, essentially that's a 2 sigma upper limit, is approximately 212 GeV. So that's consistent with the predictions of the standard model vacuum stability and Landau-Pohl arguments. But nonetheless, because the chi-squared is at a minimum near 100 GeV, this region around here is perhaps the most fertile place to look for Higgs bosons. So that's why the race was on at LEP to produce and detect Higgs bosons if they're there. We expect Higgs bosons to be produced in the Higgs-Strong process, where an off-shell Z radiates a Higgs boson and has a resonance Z in the final state as well as the Higgs boson. You need enough energy in the E plus and E minus to make both the Z and the Higgs boson, which means that there's a kinematic cutoff at root s minus mz is the maximum value of the Higgs boson mass that you can produce. Of course, the z has a bit of width, so you can stretch a little bit into the wall. This is the cross-section for Higgs boson production as a function of the Higgs boson mass for a fixed value of the center of mass energy, and this is the kinematic wall on a logarithmic scale. You can still stretch beyond it because of the z width, and also a contribution from the fusion diagram where v plus and e minus radiate w's, which can fuse to form a Higgs boson, and the neutrinos do not have to form a z boson mass in the final state. That contribution, however, is somewhat small, but it's included in all of our calculations. One, I keep that one up. The accelerator that we use is the largest scientific instrument on Earth, or was the largest scientific instrument on Earth until it was dismantled last December. They're still taking magnets out of the tunnel. It's 27 kilometers around and is situated next to Geneva. Geneva is about as big as the accelerator. It straddles the border between France and Switzerland. The Jura Mountains are here, that's Lake Geneva, and the Alps are over here. There are four experiments on the LEP accelerator, Aleph, Delphi, L3, and Opal, and given that we were concentrating on discovering something and extending our run, we had to cooperate between the four experiments and combine our data in as quickly in as quick a time frame as possible because the schedule for dismantling was quick. The maximum energy that we got was 209 GeV. In order to get more performance out of our Higgs boson searches, we needed to look very closely at the accelerator and optimize it. Remember that the Higgs boson cross-section depends crucially on the center of mass energy minus the Higgs boson mass. So to crank up the center of mass energy buys an enormous reach in Higgs boson mass. For every GeV in energy in beam energy, you get 2 GeV of mass, or for every GeV of center of mass energy, you get 1 GeV of Higgs boson mass sensitivity. You also need some luminosity, because then you can stretch a little bit beyond the wall. If you have more luminosity, then you can rack up more signal events. So we need both energy and luminosity in order to discover Higgs bosons. To raise the energy, however, the main barrier is synchrotron radiation. The amount of power that's lost due to synchrotron radiation rises with the fourth power of the beam energy and is inversely proportional to the radius of the ring. That's why LEP is so big around, is to keep the synchrotron radiation loss down so that the power bill is manageable at LEP 1. There are two ways to increase the energy of the beam. You can either add more energy per turn, or you can make LEP bigger. Adding energy per turn is the easy way to throw money at the problem, is to buy additional superconducting radio frequency cavities. All in all, 288 of these cavities were installed by the year 2000. It takes a while to build these. These were all contracted out in the early 90s. So that they would be ready for LEP 2. This is what they look like in their cryostats with waveguides from klystrons in the next room. In addition, we'd like to squeeze as much as we can out of these superconducting cavities. They were originally designed to only give 6 megavolts per meter of accelerating power. Instead, we managed to squeeze 7 megavolts per meter by conditioning them with the beam. So the more you run them during the year, the more voltage they're able to hold because the impurities get burned off the surfaces. In addition, the bunches were made shorter so as to explore the maximum accelerating part of the RF field within the cavities. This required a hardware upgrade because short bunches made the pickup antennas necessary to tune the cavities. They burned out in 1998, one at a time. So these were replaced over winter 1998, so we would be able to have short bunches in the machine. In order to keep away from the cryogenics limit, because you have to cool down these superconducting cavities, we actually bought some of the LHC cryo equipment in advance and used it for LEP. It's also good because we debugged it for them. We found some weak spots in it and fixed them. To get some more energy out of LEP, we reinstalled 8 of these copper cavities here. Actually, the cavities themselves are down here for the accelerating section. These are just RF storage spheres. They're cooled with water, which is why they look interesting. All in all, we got 3,600 megavolts of RF power per turn, which means that on every turn, each electron lost 3.6 GeV of energy due to synchrotron radiation. This is a fairly interesting place to run because klystrons trip randomly. And if you require that every klystron be on in order to keep a beam in the machine, because if a klystron trips and the orbit becomes smaller, you may run the beam into the wall and lose it very quickly. So this depends on how close you are to the maximum beam energy that's allowed for the number of klystrons that you have. So the RF margin is called how many klystrons can trip before the beam is lost. The mean time between klystron trips was about 15 minutes, and it depends on the total beam current, the beam energy, and the condition of the RF cavities in the cryogenics plant. So the way to get around the 15-minute limit is that when we start a fill of LEP and accelerate it up to the physics energy, we don't accelerate it up to the top energy that's available with no klystrons in reserve, because that means that the fill will only be 15 minutes long. What happens is that we've filled up with a lot of electrons, we run it at maybe 1 or 2 klystrons margin, we let the current drop down as physics collisions are made. There are also stray parasitic collisions with the wall and beam gas, so you lose current gradually throughout time. As the current drops enough, you get farther away from the RF trip limit, and then you can ramp the energy up a little bit, and with the remaining electrons, get a little bit more luminosity at higher energy. And then you can repeat the process until the beam is almost gone.
Does this mean you're constantly tuning? You know, what are the experimental conditions?
Almost no change at all. We were really surprised because the energy change between one mini ramp and the next was only about 500 MeV, maybe sometimes a GeV at a time. We were expecting it. We were afraid that we would have to ramp down our chambers and stick them back up, but this never happened, and the tunes never really changed. There's a bit of a change in the tunes between the injection and the final physics energy, but no change in the tunes between these energies here. Yeah, it made for a lot of interesting bookkeeping with the experiment because of the different energies during a fill. So you had to keep track for each event what energy it was taken at. This is the spectrum of the beam energies that we got, or center of mass energies, if you will, and it's quantized by how many klystrons are held in reserve. We collected a little bit. We got a teeny tiny bit, just under 209, some of it at 208 GeV at 0 klystrons reserve. The 209 was gotten on a particularly good day when everything was working really, really well. It doesn't happen very much. And the bulk of it was taken at 206.6 and at 2 klystrons of reserve here. The average energy for the year was at 206 GeV. Yeah.
Is the let's say the 208 center of mass energy, is that worth, relatively speaking, twice as much or something, or 40% or more? Or?
Yeah, you can sort of read it off here. It says, right.
So if you get an extra 2 GeV, it could be worth 3 or 4 times a day.
Yeah, and it also depends on the Higgs boson mass you're looking for.
Right,
so
right.
Well, it's not 2 or 3. Actually, this is worth a little less than that, even for 115 GeV. So most of our sensitivity comes from this one. In fact, this running was called SUSY mode, where the cross sections are very large for things like Targino production. And the SUSY guys were the ones who mostly lobbied for running at 0 klystron margin. And the Higgs guys wanted to run at 1 klystron margin. Fortunately, the LEP physics coordinator who arranges for the schedule is a Higgs aficionado, which is why the energy spectrum looks like that. The second half of optimizing the accelerators to make it a little bit bigger. Now, the tunnel's already 27 kilometers around, and the magnets are really heavy, and you can't move them. In fact, you'd probably destroy the optics if you did. So what do we do? Actually, it turns out that it's not the physical length around the ring, it's the magnetic length. It's how much of the perimeter of the ring is within bending magnets that is important for the synchrotron radiation that's emitted. The straight sections don't count. So there are two tricks to do this. One of this is to reduce the RF frequency. Actually, for some strange reason, I'll describe in a minute, you reduce the frequency of your accelerating field and you get higher energy beams. And the main reason for this is that with a lower frequency, it takes longer for the electrons to make a full turn, And since the electrons always travel at the speed of light, that means that they have to go farther. This means that they've spent more time in the dipole fields, which means that they have gentler bends and less synchrotron radiation, which means that you need less energy to replenish it for the amount of energy that the beams have. So we've gained about a half a GeV in Higgs sensitivity just by reducing the frequency of the RF cavities. Here's another trick, and that is that there were some additional dipoles in there. They were just couple loop corrector magnets that were used to fix the orbit in the horizontal direction. Turns out the orbit at LEP has always been so good that only 20 of these percent were even wired up in the first place at all. So in 1999, the remaining 80% of the horizontal corrector magnets were wired up and used as extra dipole bending. And these magnets are fairly weak. The problem is not to make your magnets strong enough. The problem is to make the bends within the magnets of the beam gentle enough. So in fact, these fields are fairly weak, but to spread it out, to spread the bending between the dipoles to include these extra bending magnets made the synchrotron radiation loss a little less. This gave us an extra quarter of a GeV in sensitivity to the Higgs boson. So I don't feel so bad about the accelerator because I think we got everything we could have out of LEP that was available, short of going back to 1995 and requesting more RF cavities. A typical detector is equally complicated as the machine. It consists of precise tracking next to the beam collision area. There is a drift chamber, calorimeters for electromagnetic particles, hadron calorimeters, and muon detection systems. You'll see each of these pieces in action when I show an event display. We need all of these pieces of our detector because of the way that the Higgs boson is expected to decay, so we can pick it up in our experiment. For the masses that we're interested in, between 100 and 115 GeV or so, the branching ratios are fairly constant. It's nearly 80% to BB bar, at about 7% to tau tau. Glu-glu is turning on, and WW is also becoming important right at 115, right at our top. In fact, it keeps on going to about 160 GeV, twice the W mass. The Higgs decays to WW almost 100% of the time. However, we're nowhere near that with our kinematic reach. We're down looking for BB bar and tau tau, mostly. The decay channels, if you'll recall, the Higgs boson is expected to be produced along with a Z. And since the Higgs's decay into Bs or taus, we look for B and tau decays here in our different channels. So the channels are labeled by their Z decay mode. You can have Z goes to QQ bar, Higgs goes to BB bar. This is called the four-jet channel. There's a missing energy channel where the Z goes to neutrinos, which are not detected, and the Higgs goes to BB bar. There's the lepton channel where the Z goes to leptons, and the tau channels where either the Higgs goes to taus or the Z can go to taus, and the other pair goes to quarks or B quarks. The background processes are very well understood at LEP, and they're all very well measured. This is just a rather convenient plot from L3 because they put them all on the same plot here. These are two photon collision contribution is the number one cross section at LEP2. There is E plus E minus goes to QQ bar, has a very large resonance at the Z pole and drops with 1 over S. A lot of this comes from radiative returns to the Z where a photon is radiated from one of the initial state electrons to take advantage of the resonant cross-section to QQ bar at a lower center of mass energy. This is the full energy cross-section to QQ bar without significant radiation, where the QQ bar has 85% of the beam energy. There's also WW, which is measured very precisely, and ZZ production. This is what you might expect from a Higgs to at 114 GeV. Each experiment has measurements of all of these processes, and they've all been averaged. The different channels are fairly elaborate now because we've had several years to work on each one of them. In the four-jet channel, we select events that have four jets in them and don't have photons that are radiative. So that means that the visible system isn't boosted strongly in the detector. Then we have a selection that combines with the likelihood or neural nets, things like the quality of the B tags. Because the LEP beam pipe is 6 centimeters away from the beam collision point, not all B tags are unambiguous. So the quality of the B tags is put into a discriminant variable, as well as things like kinematic variables that you can compute matrix elements of the events that you observe for each of the background processes and the signal. In addition, we just put the jet energies and angles and things like that into likelihoods or neural nets. We pick the best pairing in these events. There are 6 ways of pairing up 4 jets to 2 bosons. You can count that at home. And we pick the best pairing by forcing 2 jets to the Z mass or looking at B tags for the pair of jets that we think come from the Higgs. Then we pick the reconstructed mass out of the invariant mass of the jets that we assign to the Higgs, and we constrain the energy and momentum to the beam energy and momentum, and also the Z mass of the recoil, and we get an energy a mass resolution for the Higgs boson of 3 GeV in this particular channel. Then, to separate signal from background, we form a discriminant variable separately out of these neural net selection variables and the reconstructed mass for a 2-dimensional discriminant variable.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
When you have a neural net picking out the events and discriminating between them, do the neural nets need a feature?
Yeah, so we use Monte Carlo. So we have Monte Carlo signal and background samples. So the background's fairly well understood because it's all QED and electroweak physics. And the Higgs signal is, again, plain old understood gauge physics. Yes. So in order to either exclude or discover something, you have to have a clear hypothesis of what you're looking for and what you expect to see there if it's not there. Okay, show that one. The backgrounds to the 4-jet channel are, the important backgrounds to the 4-jet channel are the ones that are hard to separate from the signal. In this case, Z-pair production, which proceeds by this diagram, is one of the important ones if you're looking for a Higgs boson with a mass near MZ. Turns out we've already excluded that in previous year's data, so this isn't so much of a problem, although the Z is wide and there are tails to the mass reconstruction, which can produce some events near the kinematic edge. WW proceeds by a similar process and also an S-channel. However, since the W doesn't decay into Bs, hardly ever, you can reduce this very strongly by requiring good B tags on the candidate events. Another interesting background that we didn't worry about so much when we were looking for a Higgs near the Z mass is just plain old QQ bar production, in this case where you radiate gluons from the B quarks and tag the Bs in the event. If these gluons have an invariant mass near the Z mass, then this can look like the signal. In particular, these Bs like to be radiated back to back, and the gluons also like to be radiated near the B quarks, which means that they tend to be back to back too. If both the Bs are back to back and the gluons are back to back, then this looks like you're up near the kinematic edge and you reconstruct a mass that's the maximum possible mass that you can get. So this peaks up at the kinematic edge. Just a bit, I'll show what that looks like on the plots. Another channel that we use is a missing energy channel where we look for 2 jets plus missing momentum transverse to the beam axis. We don't worry so much about missing momentum parallel to the beam axis because you can lose photons down there and not detect them if they go down the beam pipe, and that's where initial state radiation photons like to go. We again use likelihood selections on preselected events. You look for 2 jet events that are missing momentum and have recoil masses near the Z mass. Then we again look at the B tags of the jets. We look at the direction of the missing momentum, a variable called acoplanarity, which just parameterizes the missing transverse momentum of the event. We reconstructed the mass, again, constraining the beam energy and momentum. However, we're missing 2 neutrinos in the game, which means that our mass resolution isn't going to be quite as good as it is in the 4-jet channel. It's about 7 GeV for this particular channel. Some of the backgrounds are similar. ZZ is, again, irreducible because the Z can decay into neutrinos, and the other Z can decay into B quarks. Again, this is important mostly when you're looking for Higgses near the mass of the Z. For masses of the Higgs bigger than the mass of the Z, QQ bar, again, is becoming more important, but for a different reason than it was in the 4-jet channel. In this case, you can be missing a photon down each beam pipe where the invariant mass of these 2 photons is near the mass of the Z. And then you'd be missing, in this case, the Bs would be back-to-back in your detector because you're not missing much transverse momentum in the photons because they are undetected down the beam pipe. And again, this background looks a little bit more peaked at the kinematic edge. However, it has a long tail because the reconstructed mass resolution is not as good in this particular channel. Here's an example of an event that we collected on Opal that passed our selection for Higgs candidate in the missing energy channel. Its reconstructed mass is 104 GeV, so it could be ZZ, or it could be QQ bar, could be, well, I don't know. It does have nice B tags, however. The interaction region is shown here in red, and you can see displaced vertices where a B has flown for a few millimeters and then decayed. And it's missing transverse momentum because these guys are kicked up in the positive hemisphere. So that's one of the important candidates on Opal, but it doesn't contribute very much at 115 because its mass is 104. We also look in the tau channels and the lepton channels. There are two selections for the tau channel case because we're looking for Higgs goes to tau tau as well as Z goes to tau tau. So elaborate tau ID is used, and these have different recoil mass constraints. Lepton channels are reliant on the calorimeters for identifying electrons and muons, and these require that the electron and muon pairs have the kinematic properties of a Z boson decay. We can still use the energy and momentum constraints from the beam, there are five of them, and as well as the Z mass constraint in particular is good for the muons because we're requiring to use the tracking chambers and not the calorimeters to measure the muon mass. This ZZ background in that particular channel is irreducible, but it's, again, more important when you're looking near MH equals MZ, and not so bad up above that. The typical selection efficiencies in all these channels is somewhere between 30 and 50%, depending on the Higgs boson mass and how hard you cut. And it's the not just the total efficiency, but the signal and background that are important, the ratio of the signal to background. Here's an example of a candidate in our lepton channel, which shows that we have two electrons. They leave tracks in our tracking chamber and energy deposits in our electromagnetic calorimeter, and two jets that are not associated with the electrons. This particular event gives a reconstructed mass near 90 GeV, so we think that this is Z boson pair production, which is responsible for that event. But they are pretty. Here's what the distribution of the reconstructed mass. In this case, it's for all four experiments combined. And cuts have been made on the kinematic and neural nets and likelihoods so as to give a fairly good signal over background discrimination for a 115 GeV Higgs up here. The ZZ background peaks at 90 GeV here, and the QQ bar background has a much smaller peak that's up against the kinematic edge. It's nowhere near as big as the signal in this particular case, which is rather nice when you're looking for 115 GeV Higgs signal. However, the total signal for this case of fairly hard cuts is rather small. It's on the order of two events. So the question is, where do you put your cuts when making a distribution like this of the Higgs boson reconstructed mass? There's another question of, why did we add all the different channels together when they have different mass resolutions for the signal? And the answer to both of these questions is that we don't use this histogram for anything but to show the public what it looks like. We use each channel's reconstructed mass and likelihood distribution separately, and we don't put cuts on them in order to keep the full efficiency. However, we do have to treat different regions of the channels differently in order to get the full sensitivity in an unbiased way. We need a language to take care of all of this, and that language is that of classical confidence levels. We need two hypotheses. One's the new physics hypothesis, or in this case, just the Higgs boson, production hypothesis, which is parameterized by one number, the Higgs boson mass. There's another hypothesis that's a null one, and that has no signal, it just has standard model background. We need some number that can tell what an experimental outcome looks like. Does it look like there's a signal there, or does it look like there's background there? This quantity I'll describe in a minute, but the information that goes into forming this quantity are just the events that we've observed, the estimated number of signal events, and the estimated number of background events in each bin of each histogram that we can produce. And these histograms are in the reconstructed mass, the B tags, neural nets, likelihood variables, you name it. And we can combine all of these together as long as we have Monte Carlo estimates of the signal and the background in each bin. And then the question is, of course, do you trust the Monte Carlo? But that's a separate question from the question of combining it. The estimator that we use to tell whether or not an outcome looks like a signal or the background is the ratio of the classical probabilities plus on for observing the data given the signal plus background hypothesis divided by the same probability in the background case. Those look like this, with the familiar plus on probability formulas in both the numerator and denominator. Each bin is independent of each other bin, so you can multiply all these probabilities together for all the bins in each experiment. Taking the logarithm and canceling terms in the numerator and denominator just means that this particular likelihood ratio reduces to a sum over the events in each bin times the this function of the signal over background in each bin. So in fact, we'll be talking about candidates. The particular signal over background for a particular candidate just is the signal over background in the Monte Carlo in the bin in which the candidate is found. So I'll be describing what the signal over background looks like for some particular candidates and explain why these candidates are interesting. The signal over background ratios, of course, depend on the signal and the background estimates, so they depend on the Higgs boson mass and cross-section and branching ratios. The confidence levels that I'll be showing are just answering the question of what's the probability of observing the outcome that we did given the signal plus background case as compared to the probability of observing that outcome in the background only case. So we integrate up the probability of getting the test statistic that we got or less in the signal plus background case to see if we can rule out the signal. And that's shown schematically here, that if you expect this distribution of the test statistic Q in the signal plus background case and you observe this particular value, then it looks like it's consistent with the signal plus background case. If you observe this one, which is more like the background distribution, if you observe a value somewhere over here, then the integral of the pink curve out here is going to be very small, and you can reject the signal plus background hypothesis. Contrarywise, if you would like to reject the background-only hypothesis, depending on what you observe, if you observe a value out here, say, or maybe this one, then you integrate up the background probability from the observation off to plus infinity, and if this number is small, then you can rule out the background hypothesis. Sometimes you observe a deficit of events. You don't see even enough events to that the background can account for. This is a special case in that your data is inconsistent with all models, including all the possible signal models you can come up with, because it's also inconsistent with the background. So what we do is we divide the signal plus background confidence level by the background confidence level to give us this quantity CLS. It's very similar to something proposed by the, or at least listed in the PDG statistics section before 1998 as a way to regularize CLS so that we're not claiming to exclude things to which we do not have any sensitivity. Okay. And that signal plus background, or signal over background, is the important discriminating feature in all of the histograms. It's the only common denominator in all of the searches that we have on the four LEP experiments. Everyone has done a different, very clever thing in their own search, and the only way that we can combine them is to find some common denominator. And that's the signal over background. Turns out that you can combine bins of similar signal over background and just add them. For the same reason that you can combine 1 week of data with the next week of data, the reason for that is that the signal over background is the same in both weeks of data. If you change the energy between the 2 weeks, then you can't do that. So that's what we've done here, is that we've combined all the histograms that we got from the four LEP experiments as a function of their signal over background. And then we showed the signal here in green, the estimated signal for Monte Carlo. The background estimated for Monte Carlo is a histogram, and the data candidates are shown here with the points. So immediately you can pick out the good candidates. They're the ones in the bins that have a high signal over background ratio. Another important thing that you can do is you can integrate this plot from one side. And this is answering questions such as, how many events did you see? How many events did you expect from the background? How many did you expect from the signal? We would immediately ask you, where would you like us to cut? And of course, you can cut anywhere on this plot. And this plot is the ideal, the optimal variable to place your cut, because it equalizes all the search channels, regardless of the mass resolutions and the branching ratios. So you can put the cut anywhere you like, and turns out we got a few candidates in regions where the background is rather small, but in addition, we have extra candidates where the signal background isn't quite as good. So the signal plus background hypothesis is shown here as a function of the cut. It's parameterized by the expected signal or the integral of the green curve. The background is shown in black, and the data candidates are shown with points, indicating that we observe data candidates in excess over the background, not in only the high signal over background region, but over the entire range.
Thomas, the one on the left is the same plot with a different
horizontal. Yeah, that's just different scale. So that's looking, in fact, this conveys rather little information because the total candidate count's so big that the error bar is larger.
Well, it gives the impression that even in the higher, the lower signal in the background region, you still have an excellent.
That's right. Yeah.
If I could, when I look at the upper plot, that's sort of a substitute for the mass plot you were showing, where
right.
the fact that the data seems to have a little bit of leveling off as it goes right.
That's right.
Is your signal.
That's right. Exactly.
These bins are all correlated with each other, right, in the lower plot.
Right. The lower plots, these are all correlated. These are integrals
so
from one side.
You get to pick sort of one of them.
That's right, if you will. So you can place your cut anywhere, but only the only one.
But still, you would expect it to wander back.
Well, yeah, you would expect the error bar to get big enough to cover the, right.
I mean, I agree there's memory in it because of the correlation, but eventually,
yeah, but here it's that we actually expect 8 signal events if we're willing to cut loose enough to take 20 background events. So given that this difference between signal and background is 8, it hasn't wandered back, and we're still accumulating an excess. Yeah. Yeah. Here's what it looks like, not only for 115 GV. I recomputed these with a SUSY model, so the candidates don't look exactly like the ones on the previous page. However, this is what it looks like for the hypothesis of 110 GeV Higgs boson. Even though we still have an excess of candidates, it's nowhere near what you would expect from a signal for 110 GeV Higgs boson. So we exclude that rather handily. So what are these interesting candidates way off in the end? They're the ones that you may have seen already. This one came in first, and it's one of the best ones. It was taken in the Aleph experiment in the 4-jet channel. It has 2 rather good B tags in the jets that are associated with the Higgs boson, and a reconstructed Higgs boson mass using the beam energy and momentum constraints of 114 GeV right at the kinematic edge. Another candidate that was collected by Aleph, actually 3 of the top candidates are in the Aleph 4-jet channel, so take that if you will. This one is a bit more problematic, if you will, because the 4 jets are not quite as separated as they are in the other event, so maybe it looks a bit more like the QQ bar glue kind of background. However, in this case, we have 4 good B tags in each event. These are the B tag variables, and 1 means that it's the best possible B tag, and these are very close to the best possible B tags that you can get. So it doesn't look like QQ glue because we don't expect gluons to decay into B quarks or produce B quarks very often, certainly not twice in one event. The third strong candidate from Aleph looks a bit like this. It again has 3 good B tags and a reconstructed mass that's perhaps a bit lower. I'll show what this looks like on an S over B plot so that we can see what the significance of this particular candidate is.
The resolution is about 3 jets?
Yeah. Yeah, about 3 jets. So this is Aleph's S over B as a function of the Higgs boson mass hypothesis. So for each test mass that we're looking for, we have a different central value of the signal where we expect it to pile up with a mass resolution as well as a cross-section that goes into it. So the 3 candidates that I just showed were these 3 here where the peaks are at the reconstructed masses. These don't fall down quite as fast on that side as they do on the top side because the cross-section is growing, so S is growing, so S over B is growing on this side regardless of the mass resolution. So as you go far away from the test mass with the reconstructed mass, the S over B falls, but the cross-section is picking it up. That's one reason why this candidate in the Lepton channel is nearly flat, because the reconstructed mass is somewhere off at 118 GeV, but the cross-section is growing, and the reconstructed mass resolution has a tail in it, which means that it never quite falls to zero down there, and it gets picked up by the cross-section for an almost flat curve. For a candidate, that's actually not all that interesting, so take it if you will. This fourth most interesting candidate comes from L3. It's in the missing energy channel. There are two jets that are nearly back-to-back, both in the R5 projection and in the Z projection, which indicates that perhaps this is a Higgs boson mass, Higgs boson right at the kinematic limit, which is produced at rest. Alternatively, it could be QQ bar background, where the Qs are B quarks. Here are the B tags shown here. The reconstructed mass is 114 GeV. And there's quite a lot of missing energy in this event. One could ask the question if the missing energy, I don't have the number of the missing energy with me, unfortunately. One could ask if the missing energy comes from the fact that these jets are headed for the cracks between the barrel parts of the calorimeter and the end cap parts of the calorimeter. However, L3 seems to be built fairly well in this case, where they take a lot of data at the Z0 boson calibration resonance and ask what the sum of the jet energies is and the difference of the jet energies is for events which go into the cracks. I think it's actually due to the fact that these pieces in their event display are crack covering calorimeters that pick up the additional energy that would otherwise be lost in the crack. This event's weight is currently under discussion within L3. I don't know what's going to happen to it. We're going to find out at the end of the month. It's more of a psychological event rather than a real event. It doesn't have that much weight in the total combination. It has a psychological weight because the main candidates come from the LF4 jet channel, and it's good to have another experiment in another channel which also sees candidates. So it's more of a psychological thing. So these are the S over Bs for all candidates in all experiments. Again, you see the big ones from Aleph, the big three, and there's the L3 missing energy event. That's the Aleph lepton event that I talked about. Now we go to confidence levels. Before I give confidence level numbers, I'd like to remind about this picture. This is the distribution of the test statistic Q, that's likelihood ratio of signal plus background divided by background probability in the signal plus background case and the background case. So that's what's shown here as a function of the test mass, or the mass of the Higgs boson that we're looking for, which may be different from the mass of the Higgs boson that might be present in the data. It might be different from the reconstructed masses of the candidates that we observed. So this is the distribution of the likelihood ratio with 1 and 2 sigma bands drawn around it for the background-only hypothesis, shown in green and yellow. The red line is the observed value of the likelihood ratio, showing that it has an excursion outside of the 2 sigma probability from the background. There is a lower value of the likelihood ratio here, so we're observing something in this direction, which is more signal-like. So down is more signal-like on this plot, up is more background-like. The lower the Higgs boson mass there is, the more cross-section there is, the easier it is to tell signal from background. So you actually expect large values for low values of the Higgs boson mass, and it becomes more difficult to separate signal from background for things that are beyond our kinematic reach. Just at the very edge, however, we have observed something in excess from what we have expected from the background, and it's consistent with what we expect from a 115 GeV Higgs signal. This is the expectation shown with the dotted line of what the minimum of this curve should look like as a function of the true Higgs boson mass in the data, if it were there. That's the slice of it shown here, the same kind of plot as that, for all four LEP experiments combined. That's the signal plus background hypothesis and the background-only hypothesis. And what we show is the confidence level for the background hypothesis, i.e., what's the probability that the background can fluctuate up to the candidates that we observe, is the integral of the curve of this green curve here, which is 4 times 10 to the minus 3. So if you ran the experiment for maybe, in this case, a few hundred times, I guess, on the order of 500 times, you'd expect maybe one of them to give a outcome that looks as much like a signal as the one that we got. So this is 1 minus CLB, this probability that the background can fluctuate up to the candidates, as a function of the mass of the Higgs boson that we're looking for. And we get a excess of 115 GeV, which is exactly what we would expect from 115 GeV standard model Higgs boson signal. So let's break this up into different pieces. Which experiment is seeing it and in which channels? Well, you already knew from the candidates that I showed you that the Aleph experiment has seen an excess over their background expectation. In fact, they see more than they expect in median from the signal. They're a bit on the high end on both cases, but still consistent with the signal expectation. Delphi sees a bit of a deficit. They're below the peak in the background expectation. L3, with their missing energy candidate, sees more than they expect from the background, but it's still not all that improbable by themselves. And Opal is in the same situation. What they see is consistent with both the signal and the background, but maybe we slightly prefer the signal, but only by a little bit. The different channels are broken up here. These are LEP combined results for each of the search channels separately. The lepton channel doesn't have that much separation between the signal and background hypothesis, nor does the Chow channel, because the cross-sections are rather low. These channels are not so much the discovery channels as they are the verification channels. If you had a Susie Higgs boson, then the ratio of lepton and tau channel to the, say, four-jet channel will be different than it is in the standard model. Not for any particularly interesting reason, but for the rather prosaic reason, if you have HA production, you can get four-jet events, but not ZH events, so you'd be missing your lepton channel events. So you need lots of events to untangle the MSSM from the standard model at LEP. So these are the excesses in the different channels. We see a bit, we see an excess in the four-jet channel, mainly from Aleph. There's a bit of an excess in the missing energy channel from that L3 event, and nothing real in the lepton or the tau channels. We can ask ourselves, now that we've seen an excess, can we still exclude some values of the Higgs boson mass? And the answer is, of course, because the cross-section grows very rapidly as the Higgs boson gets lighter than the kinematic edge. This means that because we haven't observed even more candidates than we did, we can exclude masses below 113.5 GeV using the CLS variable that I described before. The expected limit, shown here with the blue dashed line, is 115.3 GeV. This is determined by that's essentially our sensitivity of our experiment. We don't expect to be able to exclude masses above that. In fact, we excluded significantly below that, which is just another way of saying that we have excess candidates in our data. One can ask the question of, given that we have this excess pretty much everywhere, if we look for 104 GeV Higgs boson, we have an excess over what we expect at median, which is blue dash curve. At 115 GeV, we have the biggest excess. All the same candidates contribute to all these points, so all these points are correlated, of course. But the question is there a background excess that's general everywhere that just happened to have fluctuated up there? Do we understand our background, or could this be due to a signal? And the answer is, because of our mass resolutions of the different candidates, if you actually had 115 GeV Higgs boson signal in the data, what would it look like if we were looking for 105 GeV Higgs boson? Will some of the candidates count as 105 GeV Higgs boson signal? In fact, it will. This is a plot of the test statistic as a function of the test mass, of the Higgs boson mass that we're looking for. And this is the expectation if they're shown in a black dotted line. If there actually were 115 GeV Higgs boson present in the signal, you would actually expect to see something that's more signal-like at 110 GeV and below than was actually observed. So you would expect this minimum to, in fact, be rather shallow and to have the same candidates which contribute up here pull down the distribution just about everywhere on the plot. So, in fact, this is expected behavior from a signal. And this is what the mass resolutions look like for the different channels. This is an Opal example, so signal Monte Carlo from Opal and the four-jet, missing energy, lepton, and tau channels. And one can see that right up against the kinematic edge, our mass resolution is not Gaussian at all. There's a kinematic cutoff imposed by our energy and momentum constraint in our fit. And this gives only the lower tail and not a symmetric upper and lower tail. So in fact, given that we have candidates between 100 and 110 GeV reconstructed mass, this is perfectly consistent with 115 GeV Higgs boson. So there's no problem with having candidates with slightly lower mass. But it also means that a true Higgs boson signal at 115 GeV will be spread out over the entire range and affect the confidence level everywhere. So just to give a little bit of history of LEP, in 1976, LEP got its start with the first design studies. Final design studies were in 1979. Then for 12 years, LEP ran E plus E minus collisions The first six were done at the Z0 resonance, and then the energy was slowly increased up until 2000 when we got a maximum energy of 209 GeV. We reported these results on November 3rd, 2000, which is one day after the last day of LEP running, which meant that we had to be very fast with collecting our data, calculating the confidence levels, and combining the results for four experiments, producing the talk, and getting it approved by four experiments before the next day. This was rather difficult. Fortunately, we got really good at this because we had to do it several times in the year before. No. In fact, some of us didn't even sleep since May of 2000 or so because we had to turn this crank several times. The experiments requested an additional run in 2001. Not that the significance of the excess is 2.9 sigma, that's 4 times 10 to the minus 3 in terms of Gaussian sigma. That's not enough to claim that we have evidence for having observed the Higgs boson, but it is enough to get worried about it, and it's enough to investigate it further, either at LEP or at the next round of colliders. So we requested all four experiments requested additional running in 2001. This was turned down by the Committee of Council on November 13, where the member states sent their representatives and actually didn't produce a recommendation at all. The CERN Director General made the decision with no recommendation from the Council that we would continue with the LHC schedule as planned. LEP was declared finished, and we started dismantling in November and December. We should be publishing things this summer, but there's quite a lot of work to be done finishing off our analysis and publishing them, not just for the standard model Higgs, but also for extended Higgs sectors, which I talked about yesterday in a seminar. One can ask ourselves the question of where would you bet that the Higgs boson is? And to answer such a question, you need not just the classical frequentist interpretation of the shown there using the likelihood ratio. One needs to incorporate other bits of information like the precision electroweak results to form an opinion of whether or not this thing could possibly have been real. So we use Bayes' theorem, which talks about probabilities of hypotheses. What's the probability that the Higgs boson mass is 115 GeV? So this isn't actually a probability, it's a degree of belief. It's how much do you believe that the Higgs boson mass is 115 GeV, and that's parameterized by how much we have observed in our direct searches and also the electroweak fits. One can also stir in those vacuum stability arguments, but then that means that you don't believe that there's any physics beyond the standard model, and we wouldn't be here if we didn't believe something else. So if we turned off those theory constraints and only put the precision electroweak and the direct measurements, we get approximately a 37% chance, just integrating the spike at 115 due to the excesses in the direct search, approximately a 37% chance that there's a Higgs boson under 116 GeV. Now, this is a tremendous probability given the tremendous consequences of the Higgs boson being there, in particular because the standard model by itself cannot account for a Higgs boson of mass 115 GeV. This would have momentous implications for people doing supersymmetry and searches for additional exotica.
Why do they take uniform Brian law?
That's the problem with doing a Bayesian analysis of any sort, because there is no justification for a prior.
Well,
yeah.
A Bayesian would say the advantage to Bayesian is that you have to be explicit about your bias.
Yeah.
Right? Frequently doesn't have to answer the question. You can't answer the question. So I guess one issue is, has someone done the Bayesian interpretation not logarithmic with uniform prior?
Unfortunately, that sort of that biases towards higher Higgs boson masses from the electroweak fit, because the electroweak chi-squared is a function of the logarithm of the Higgs boson mass. So you get a more symmetric error bar in that particular variable.
But,
yeah, I think so.
I think it's kind of, another way of rephrasing it is the observables in the electroweak fit are
logarithmic. Right. Yeah, that's why. So where's the competition for LEP? Actually, it's not even competition anymore because LEP isn't playing the game anymore. The next place to look for the Higgs boson in the standard model is at the Tevatron. This is the standard plot that everyone shows about how much luminosity is necessary in order to have either 2 sigma or 95% confidence level sensitivity to a Higgs boson of different mass, 3 sigma or 5 sigma, which is what you would need in order to discover it. We've set our limit at 113.5 GeV at LEP, which means that one would need from the Tevatron essentially run 2A in order to get sensitivity for Higgs bosons to exclude a little bit more than the LEP bound has already excluded. But it takes about 10 to 20 inverse femtobarns in order to be able to discover something at this level. It would be nice, however, to have someone from the LEP Higgs working group planted on the Tevatron Higgs working group to see if there's some way that we can combine this information. Perhaps not in a way that people would believe as a honest-to-goodness discovery, but enough to get some support for running a linear collider to study whether or not a Higgs boson at 115 GeV, if it's actually there. If we have enough combined evidence that it's there, then we'd like to produce it in quantity and measure its branching ratios and its couplings. If it doesn't pan out, there's a fallback solution back in Europe. That's what we took LEP apart for, is to put the magnets in for the LHC. The energy of the LHC is much larger. It's 14 TeV in the same tunnel of 27 kilometers around. Here the problem is magnet strength. These magnets are all superconducting, and you need a large tunnel in order to allow the magnets to be as weak as they are. They're still quite strong in order to bend the particles around in the loops that they have to go. So this is a plot from the ATLAS technical design report showing that with 30 inverse femtobarns, that they have sensitivity at the 5 sigma level to Higgs bosons of mass all the way from 100 GeV to 1 TeV. But there's a tremendous mixture of different final states that they look for, such as gamma gamma, Higgs 2, ZZ, decaying into 4 leptons, which is important below the WW resonance and resonant decay mode, and above the WW resonant decay mode. And right at 160 GeV, they look for Higgs to WW, goes to LNU-LNU. So it's mostly ZZ, which is why the LHC experiments focus on electron and muon identification, because the low background mode is in the 4 lepton decays of the two Zs. So in summary, LEP was pushed as hard as it would go. I don't worry so much that there is something just out there, just beyond the reach of LEP, because I think we reached with LEP as far as it would possibly go. I don't think there was anything left that we could have done. The excess was observed in the standard model Higgs search at the level 2.9 sigma, and this has a probability of 4.2 times 10 to the minus 3 at Higgs mass of 115 GeV, and it's consistent with what we expect from a standard model Higgs signal. However, it's not enough to claim that we have evidence for observation. This is just something that we should be following up on with future experiments. We also rule out Higgs bosons below 113.5 GeV. Tevatron is next, and the LHC is beyond that. Thank you. So, some questions? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
This is not so much on your work, but it's just a more general question.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, let me preface it with, it turns out in the early 70s there were some people who said PEP 1 was the wrong energy. And they fought very hard at Slack to try to get PEP 1 to be a Z0.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned PEP 1 into LEP. And I'm wondering, during the 80s when the LEP tunnel was being really finalized,
mm-hmm.
was there anyone, even though, and in the 80s, supersymmetry was on, it was the first blooming of supersymmetry was in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anyone at all who was saying, look, the lightest Higgs in supersymmetry has to be lighter than the Z0? To cover your bet, why not just make LEP go to 300?
Yeah, the original LEP 1 Yellow Book of 1984 said that 200 GeV would be the top, and I'm not entirely sure why the choice was 200 GeV. It may have been how much they expected all the RF to cost and how much it would be expected to run. As it is, they got more performance out of their RF than they expected, but they could have asked for another 50 cavities, for instance, and they could have jacked the energy up to 230 or so. 300 is really tough because e to the fourth kicks in really hard. up there, and I'm not sure if that would be runnable at 300.
If you look at the incremental cost of making that 300 jet, compare it to the cost of linear flying.
Yeah.
But you're already borrowing from a certain pension fund.
Right. That's right. In fact, they knocked 2% off my salary as a CERN associate in 1996 in order to buy all this stuff. Right.
The odd thing is, I know this story from Cap One. People already were guessing, don't bother at 30 jets.
But a better question is why hobble the linear collider at 500 or lower when you can build maybe one TeV linear collider? Because there might be some spectrum up there which would be very interesting to explore. So you're always trying to answer the same question of what to build next. Yeah.
So it's kind of going over the past mistakes.
Yeah.
Make us a little smarter.
Sure.
I mean, I know with Cap 1 there are people who predicted it and were upset.
But the good news is, at least in the Higgs case, even if it's just plain old boring standard model all the way up to the Planck scale, you would still have something that would appear either at the Tevatron or the LHC. And then we would know where to build the linear collider so we can study the thing a little bit better. If it comes out light, then we have reason to believe that there's more out there, and then we can build our linear collider sooner.
Okay, no other questions, but thank Tom for a beautiful talk.